One whistleblower has had more of an impact on international transportation than any other single person in the last decade when he disclosed over 100,000 documents showing the dark side of one of the most popular rideshare companies in the world. Hello, I'm John Kiriakou, and you're watching The Whistleblowers. Whistleblower Mark McGann disclosed more than 124,000 documents detailing how Uber flouted laws in countries across Europe, duped police, exploited violence against drivers, and secretly lobbied governments in order to aggressively build its global empire. The 52-year-old Irishman served as Uber's chief lobbyist for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa from 2014 to 2016 and oversaw government relations and public policy in more than 40 countries. He was responsible for courting governments in more than 40 countries to convince them that Uber was the next big thing. Investment opportunities abounded. People around the world wanted to get in on the ground floor. Executives threw themselves at the company, hoping to work for what they thought was the next Google or Apple. And Uber presented itself as a life-changing opportunity, especially for low-income people with access to a car. They could work for themselves as many hours a day as they wanted. The sky was the limit to what they could accomplish. But it wasn't all that easy, and the picture wasn't really that rosy. The company began facing pushback, especially from taxi drivers. Protests erupted in Berlin, London, Paris, and Athens. Courts in Germany restricted some of Uber's services, and in Greece, the company was banned altogether. McGann was put in charge of a team that was to confront these challenges. He argued that Uber was not anti-regulation. It was a tech company, he said, using data to match supply with demand. But in reality, it was much more than that. McGann later said, quote, "The mantra that people repeated from one office to the other was the mantra that came from the top. Don't ask for permission. Just hustle, enlist drivers, go out, do the marketing, and quickly people will wake up and see what a great thing Uber is," unquote. In reality, Uber was running roughshod over the status quo. Gig work in many countries offered no benefits, long hours, low pay, and grinding work conditions. Uber wasn't the great job opportunity it marketed itself to be, the opportunity that would lift people out of poverty. And to make matters worse, the company's leadership knew that from the beginning. Finally, earlier this summer, Mark McGann provided 124,000 pages of internal Uber documents to The Guardian newspaper, which in turn shared them with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and with the most important newspapers in the Western world. The documents, which cover the period from 2013 to 2017, laid bare the company's tactics to establish footholds and to win market share, even if that meant violating the law. Now we want to bring in an Uber expert whose knowledge of the economics of transport competition and regulation allowed him to demonstrate that Uber is incapable now or in the future of ever earning profits. His Uber analysis through mid-2017 was incorporated into his Transportation Law Journal article called "Will the Growth of Uber Increase Economic Welfare?" I want to welcome Hubert Horan. Welcome to the show. You're an expert on Uber and on transportation. Tell us in brief where you think Uber stands right now as a company in our society. Is it something indispensable and that will be with us for a long time? Or is it the type of company with a business model that is outmoded or just can't last for very long?
Uber is phenomenally unsuccessful against any measurable, objective criteria you can think of: economic, financial, transportation. It's racked up $31 billion in losses. It took 11 years to produce the very first dollar of positive cash flow. No one at Uber or following Uber can produce a plausible story how those massive years of losses can suddenly be turned around and become years of large and sustainable profits. It's now producing less taxi service at much higher prices than traditional taxis did, the ones that it drove out of business before it started. All of its claims that its stock would be highly valuable because it would achieve Amazon-type profitable growth in its core business, which is to say urban transport, and then profitably explained into lots of other businesses, have been proven to have been total nonsense. Uber keeps claiming that, oh, we hit problems in the past, but those were fixed 4 years ago when we changed CEOs. But in those 4 years, Uber has done nothing to fix its awful basic economics.
Are all ride-sharing companies operating on this same broken business model?
Lyft is concentrated in the domestic U.S. in a narrower set of markets than Uber, but it's the identical business model, yes, and it's losing money and has no plausible story. An even better example is Didi in China, which actually achieved the virtual monopoly market dominance that Uber was set out to achieve 10 years ago, and it still can't make money. So there's no evidence anywhere on the planet that this kind of business model, from just pure standpoint of finances, can produce anything. My research, which started 6-7 years ago, was basically focused on that question. Uber's underlying business model was always incapable of either improving the transport service in big cities or generating the kinds of profits that investors needed. Its claims about technological advances were never demonstrated and were always false. Its business model is actually less efficient and produces at higher costs than all the traditional taxi business model did. It never had the kind of big scale and network economies that allowed other venture capital backed firms to, quote, grow into profitability after initial losses. Now, the old taxi industry had lots of problems that, as everyone knows, but Uber's business model didn't fix any of them. Uber's business model couldn't profitably produce lots of additional drivers at low fares on Saturday night when peak demand hit or when it rained. All of Uber's early popularity and growth was driven by billions and billions in unsustainable investor subsidies. It's trying now, those subsidies have basically run out, and it's raised fares enormously, but there's no evidence that the mass market that Uber and these other companies are pursuing will ever pay the true cost of the service. You could be a tiny, tiny niche serving wealthy people, but the mass market that was the heart of the Uber business model can't be served properly. It's to the extent that it's improved, or it's reduced its losses, let me not say improved profitability, it's almost entirely driven by squeezing driver compensation. It has nothing to do with scale economies or improved efficiency. It is simply cutting driver pay.
What's wrong with the business model, and is there a solution?
They've been producing those $31 billion in losses over time. If there was a solution, I think they would have found it by now. I think they would have found it years ago. I don't think there's a solution, but I think the evidence that they can't produce money, you know, suddenly make this service profitable is the real demonstration. A niche, high-priced taxi service that is limited to the pockets of highest demand in the city is not a viable business. They're trying to scale back to that, which, again, reduces the cash drain, but doesn't make it a profitable business. If you research Uber, you won't find anyone who says, oh yes, here is what Uber could do to become sustainably profitable. No one has made that other than just sort of scratching their belly and announcing wishful thinking. No one can lay out, here's how they improve the economics, here's how they improve revenue, here's how they improve efficiency and productivity to make it work. And again, if there was a way, they would have done it by now.
Is it only a matter of time before Uber and these other similar companies just collapse?
Well, the anomaly here is that Uber had an unprecedented level of investor funding in its earliest years. I think it was Uber's pre-IPO funding, I might not get the remember the number exactly right, was 1,600 times more funding than Amazon had before its IPO. Amazon and Facebook and companies like that lost money at first, but they quickly got to becoming cash flow positive, and they funded their growth out of user revenue. Uber was never able to do that. All of those subsidies, again, were designed to sort of create the impression back in 2014 and 2017. Oh, Uber has found a way that no taxi company had found in 100 years to produce service, way more service, higher quality service, and at much lower prices. That was all false. It was just, they were subsidizing all the trips. They were subsidizing drivers. They were subsidizing everything. They were using those subsidies to fool investors into thinking that it had Amazon-type growth economics. And oh yeah, we lost money last year, but just like Amazon, those will soon be, you know, spouting more money than we can count. The subsidies eliminated competition from all of the prior traditional taxi operators. So there was no alternative. The subsidies funded all of the massive political lobbying and PR programs that led politicians to eliminate all the industry oversight that had protected consumers, you know, enforced labor laws, and led the mainstream media, oh, Uber's the greatest thing since sliced bread. My friends all love it. And it's all this technology and efficiency is really wonderful. But those subsidies, the power and the early popularity, meant the mainstream media never actually investigated any of those claims. And yes, they've all been proven to be complete garbage subsequently, but no one's gone back and written, oh, all those stories we told you about Uber in 2016, 2018, they were totally wrong.
How does Uber squeeze its drivers?
Well, step one, you create a quasi-monopoly. And again, think of Uber and Lyft if you're looking at the US situation as a duopoly that's driven the traditional operators out of business. So we're the only game in town. Uber aggressively lied to drivers in its early years. There were press releases, literally Uber press releases saying Uber drivers in New York are $90,000 a year. Complete dishonesty. And all sorts of other things, and there were FTC fines for some of this statement. But so all of a sudden these drivers are now driving for Uber. Go back 8 years or whatever, they're getting okay pay. They're getting better pay than the old company would do because of those subsidies. Uber's now owns the market. It simply turns around and cuts the pay. You know, how much of each customer dollar does the driver get? It's been cut back and cut back and cut back. And the drivers have absolutely no recourse. They lied to drivers, oh, you'll have total flexibility as an independent contractor. Only drive when you feel like it. Well, no, that was a lie too, because the drivers who didn't respond to the Uber's demand for drivers when they needed them simply got fired, you know. And you can't operate. It was always a lie. You can't operate a large-scale transportation company or probably any other kind of company on purely casual workers who show up when they feel like it. That was always nonsense. And Uber knew throughout this that, you know, the mainstream media and its wealthy users who liked it the most didn't care what drivers were being paid. They didn't care that they'd been squeezed down to minimum wage level. They didn't care that lots of them were sleeping in cars in order to make ends meet. And Wall Street actually thinks those are wonderful things. That kind of transfer of wealth from labor to capital, even if it's the most marginal labor in an urban marketplace, to Silicon Valley investors. That's how capitalism ought to work. They think it's wonderful. So no one was going to push back. You know, whenever those politicians who were being handled buckets of cash by Uber lobbyists and who gutted all of the protections that had existed for decades and decades, when, you know, the democratic process somehow, oh, wait a minute, this isn't working. We, you know, minimum wage doesn't cut it. Let's put some basic protections in. Let's beef up Uber's exploitation, false claims about independent contractors. As you saw with California Proposition 22, they spend unlimited cash to beat those back. You know, Uber had more lobbyists in California than the entire banking industry. Uber had more lobbyists in Nevada than the casino industry. This was not free markets at work. This was a Silicon Valley funded company where the investors were looking for the kind of riches Amazon and Facebook had generated, going to politicians with lots of cash saying, please pave the way so we have unlimited power over workers and consumers.
Thank you, Hubert, but don't go away. We're going to a short break, and when we come back, we answer the question, how vital have Mark McGann's revelations been to Hubert's work analyzing Uber's less than transparent business practices? You're watching The Whistleblowers. Stay tuned.
Dass diese Gefährdung des Friedens in Europa ausschließlich von der Russischen Föderation und ausschließlich von Wladimir Putin.
Ich habe mit Menschen im Keller gesessen. Wenn die ukrainische Armee auf Gorlovka geschossen hat, ich habe die Häuser in Frontmail gesehen. Donbass war zerstört.
Американцы на сегодняшний момент времени в Германии контролируют практически все.
Политические круги США планировали вообще ликвидировать Германию как страну.
В Германии должна была быть уничтожена промышленность. В Германии должны были быть только крестьяне, которые выращивают картофель.
Берлин verhängt diese Sanktionen ja nicht. Diese Sanktionen werden aus Washington diktiert und Deutschland frisst diese Sanktionen.
Weiß ich nicht, inwiefern die Bevölkerung, also auch die Geduld der Deutschen, ist dann wahrscheinlich irgendwann vorbei.
Weil Deutschland in Europa liegt und Amerika nicht. Unsere Nachbarn sind Russen.
We need to counter the Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, Ruptly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're discussing Mark McGann, the whistleblower who exposed illegality at Uber. We want to welcome back our Uber expert, Hubert Horan. Welcome back, Hubert. We're discussing Mark McGann's revelations here on this program. How vital were his revelations to your own work?
The Guardian series that included McGann's statements were factually accurate. But they were simply reminding the public of stuff that had been widely reported 5-6 years ago. You know, the magnitude and importance of all of those lobbying, all those things I quoted you about the magnitude of lobbying in California and Nevada. That'd been in the press at the time. Everyone knew that dozens of major politicians had been working actively to help Uber in return for those donations. Programs like Grayball, explicitly designed to obstruct law enforcement, that had been on the front page of the New York Times. Open efforts to intimidate critical journalists, ongoing programs to pay academic to produce totally indefensible findings that it knew no one would ever critique properly, but it could then incorporate into its PR programs, that had been reported years ago. So nice to have a reminder of all that stuff. But especially in the US, it's not going to overcome the magnitude of the lobbying cash and the legal changes. No one cares.
What do you know about Uber in the developing world?
Its position in those kinds of countries is somewhat limited. I'm not sure of how its South American coverage would really split out between the large wealthier cities, the São Paulos and Santiago's and Buenos Aires's, Bogota of the world, versus less developed parts of those countries. Stuff elsewhere, they failed. Uber failed in China, they failed in Russia, they failed in Southeast Asia. So there are other local companies following this with probably a little more sensitivity to the labor and transport issues in those things. But as I mentioned, in terms of Didi in China, none of them work.
Will Uber ever break up?
Urban transport, it has humongous economic problems. That's why the New York City subway and the Denver bus system and services, whether it's in Mumbai or Moscow, are not private sector businesses funded by investors hoping to get fabulously rich. They're quasi-public services. The benefits produced by urban transport, be they expressways or transit, or buses and taxis, has always been a small part of that, are fundamentally, the economics are awful. And Uber, as I said, Uber didn't solve any of those problems. It's urban transport. Why anyone thought that Uber, after 100 years of every urban transport service being a public sector operated and funded service, was suddenly a way for Silicon Valley investors to get rich, is incomprehensible. But that's what happened. Oh, we have an app. We have technology. Technology can solve every problem known to man. And everyone in the urban transport industry, in every country in the world, in every city in every country, was too stupid in the last 100 years to see that if you just put it on an app, the economics will be totally transformed. The totally stupid people were the Uber investors who bought that, and all of the politicians and media observers who swallowed that hook, line, and sinker without thinking about it. You go back and read all the stories about Uber's growth, no one ever talked to anyone who knew anything about urban transport. It was all technology stuff. Technology is cool, but technology cannot and has not transformed urban transport into something that will spit off returns for speculative investors.
We've covered so much here. Any final comments to wrap up what we've discussed?
I'm always asked to speculate on the future, and I hate doing that. If people say, well, what's going to happen? One, if nothing else in the world changed, the investor cash could probably last another 4 or 5 years. There is no political force anywhere in the more developed world to say, this was a mistake, we have to restore the kind of taxi industry we had in 1990. We have to roll back what Uber did. There's no support for that. Not because it's a bad idea, but politically, there's no support for that. To the extent, so if everything else, there would be muddle along, maybe being cash break even and constantly trying to shrink back with service in cities continuing to deteriorate, prices continuing to go up. The issue for Uber is the stock price. If its investors suddenly wake up tomorrow and said, this is never going to be worth anything. We're not going to ever become profitable. We're not going to experience Amazon-like growth and bail on the stock. And I don't think that, again, all these folks have drunk enough Kool-Aid to not be able to think about that critically. But if you look at the collapse of the broader tech bubble, which is happening, that's caused a lot of people in other contexts to say, oh, this technology stuff was not as wonderful as the press releases said. Oh, these companies that grew fast without any sign of profitability, that was really dumb, and none of them turned into successes. None since Amazon 15, 20 years ago. If they're that and pressured by higher interest rates and an overall decline in the stock market, you no longer have massive federal programs basically designed to increase stock market speculation and inflate those kinds of bubbles. If that kinds of bursts from those kinds of external forces, I think that is more likely to be what drives changes than anything else.
Hubert Horan, thank you so much for joining us. That's all we have for you today. This has been The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll catch you next time.